And you're listening to another episode of the Developing Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Miles, and this is the podcast focused on the non-technical side of being a developer, because having a career in development is about more than the code you write. This is episode 8 of season 3, or episode 47 of the whole series. The show notes for this episode, you can find them at developingup.com/47. If you're a returning listener, thanks for joining us on another episode. I think you'll be excited for this one. If you're a new listener, welcome. I hope you really enjoy this episode, so much so that you want to go back to our whole backlog and catch up. That's at developingup.com, which has all our previous episodes for all our previous seasons. I don't really get starstruck that often, but in this episode with our guests, I admit I was. Today, I'm talking with Dave Thomas and Andy Hunt. Dave and Andy are internationally recognized as leading voices in the software development community, and they've been in it for decades. They consult and speak around the world, and together they founded the Pragmatic Bookshelf, which publishes award-winning, leading-edge books for software developers. They're also two of the authors of the Agile Manifesto, for anyone out there who uses Agile methodology. And they're also the authors of The Pragmatic Programmer, a book that I've read multiple times, and that was just released with a 20th anniversary edition that Dave and Andy went through and revised and updated. And it's just as relevant for a career in development as it was 20 years ago. Before I get into this episode, something special for all listeners, speaking of The Pragmatic Programmer and the 20th anniversary edition. So if you go to informit.com/developingup. So that's informit.com/developingup. That'll take you a link to the book. And on checkout, you can use the discount code developingup, all one word. That's going to get you 35% off the book. I'll mention that again at the end of the show. So let's get into it. This is me talking with Dave Thomas and Andy Hunt on pragmatism. Andy and Dave, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Developing Up today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, totally our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
So just for any of the developer listeners out there who may not know who you are, why don't you give a little background about your history in development, really high level.
Now, the audience at home can't see this, but Dave just pointed to me, so I guess get to go first. I'm Andy Hunt. I've written some software. Started off when, you know, dinosaurs grazed under the windows, and I'm still trying to figure out how to do it in a better fashion, a better manner. Learned a lot over the years, obviously, and when Dave and I were often consulting in the mid-90s, that's when we started to realize that, hey, we had a handle on a better way of doing things. And a lot of the folks that we talked to did not seem to have this information to hand. So we thought we'd write a little white paper together to give to our clients. And unlike every other software project ever, that project grew in scope and became the Pragmatic Programmer.
So that was back in 1998, 99. And so in the intervening 20 years, we've learned a lot more. We've learned how to express ourselves differently in some cases. We got feedback from people. And so 20 years on, we produced the new version of the Pragmatic Programmer, the 20th anniversary edition.
So let me ask, because I've read your book many times throughout my career, being that it's the 20th anniversary edition, what's the most impactful change you've seen in the career, the field of development over the past 20 years?
Well, I think it's interesting. A lot of people would say, oh, it's got a lot more difficult. And I don't think it has. I think it's always been difficult. I think it's just that with the tools we have now, we can achieve more given that same level of commitment as we had. I think a lot of what's changed, though, is the interaction between community of programmers and the rest of the world. Even back in 2000, we were kind of like the people that program those boxes that work in the big rooms. And we had a lot of impact, but it was kind of isolated into like, a billing system here or an online system there. I think 20 years on, it's fair to say that the world runs on software and that developers everywhere are helping to shape the future. And what that means is, first of all, it's a whole bunch of fun, but along with that comes a whole bunch of responsibility. So I would say that one of the most significant changes for us, at least, is this idea that, as developers, we have to become responsible for the work that we do.
Now, would you say that's the difference between someone who treats being a developer as a career versus someone who treats it as a job, about how they approach the responsibility they have when they build something?
I think that's sort of an orthogonal issue to that. I mean, whether you accept that responsibility or not, it's still there. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether this is just a job to you or that you consider this, as you should, you know, your career, and this is important. The power is still there. You know, the responsibility is still there. So that's kind of a separate question, I think.
I think we've got to be careful when we talk about career as well, because traditionally when you say career, it's your lifelong vocation. It's, you know, I am a doctor or whatever. And that's not the way I see career. I think what developers do, I would rather say engaged and not engaged. So there are some developers who are engaged in what they do. They're actively learning. They are thinking about the consequences of what they do. They're looking to do what is best for the customer in a kind of like more abstract way than simply just doing what they're told. And there are those that are, in England, there was a phrase, Jobsworth. And a Jobsworth was somebody who basically did the minimum amount possible. And whenever anybody asks for something, you know, they would say, oh, I don't know, Gov, that's more than a Jobsworth. And that's the kind of attitude I see in a lot of programmers as well. So I would say that it's engaged rather than not engaged is the big difference there. And yes, an engaged programmer is looking at the responsibility side of what they do.
And just to follow on that for a moment, another aspect of that is you'll get a lot of developers who identify too closely with whatever technology they're working with at the moment. So you'll see people who say, introduce themselves as, I'm a Java programmer, or I'm an iOS developer.
They're just looking for sympathy, that's all.
Maybe that's it, right, a shoulder to cry on. But that's not your identity. I mean, that happens to be the tech that you're using at the moment, and 5 years from now, you might well be using something completely different. So, you know, I encourage people not to over-identify that way, because even saying, you know, I'm a programmer or I am a developer, that's really not the whole picture either. Really, we're problem solvers.
Mm-hmm. And I'm improving the future with software.
Yeah, or problem makers sometimes. But
yeah. I was gonna say, yeah. Okay, I'm changing the future with software. How about that?
There you go. Hopefully for the better, but
hopefully.
You know,
who can tell? Who can tell?
And so everybody who does this has that responsibility, whether they want to take it or not, with your comment about being engaged or not engaged in it. Is that why you know, when you wrote The Pragmatic Programmer, do you see people who practice more pragmatism in their work are more engaged and take more of that responsibility?
Yeah, I think it's actually almost a definition that pragmatism is effectively doing what works. And there's a whole set of dimensions to that, from being cognizant of your particular role and your particular future and your path, taking responsibility for keeping yourself up to date, being responsible for the project that you're on, and again, doing what works, being responsible to the society in which you live, and again, trying to do what works. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, pragmatism in a way is simply defined by, you know, people that are actively engaged in trying to do what works.
And again, I think there's a real tie in there. Engaged is really about awareness, because if you are engaged, if you are aware of what's going on within your company, within the industry, with updates to your tech, whatever, if you're aware of all this, you're going to be more pragmatic in your decisions, because you'll know what works or what to be suspicious of. And the opposite, I think, is very true. When you shut down that sort of awareness and just dogmatically pursue, well, this is the method we were told to use, this is the tool we were told to use, you know, when you just kind of shut off that input, then you're being dogmatic, which is the exact opposite mm-hmm. of being pragmatic. So I think
When you say know what works, though, I mean, there's a subtle trap in there as well. And that's the tense of the word work, because ultimately you don't know what works. All you know is what worked in the past.
True point.
And sometimes it may change, you know, so sometimes the environment changes, the world changes, the requirements change, and what used to work doesn't work. So what Andy said is absolutely true. The idea of being dogmatic by saying, this is what works, that's almost guaranteed to make you considerably less optimal and considerably less happy in the end than someone that's constantly adapting to try to discover what works, what doesn't work at the time, at that moment.
That's where I like in the book, in one chapter you talk about tracer code, right? Where you're writing just enough to see what works, and then you smooth out the edges or you fill in the rest as you're learning about what actually does and does not work.
Yeah, and in fact, the new book has that chapter, but it also has a chapter or a section entitled "Don't Outrun Your Headlights," which is the same kind of thing, but taken sort of the opposite way around. Is how do you know when you're stretching, right? So the idea is don't take decisions further out than you can actually see.
You know, you say right in chapter one that, you know, it's your life, you own it. And I took that to mean like, you know, it's your career and development, you own it, or you're as engaged in your development as you want to be.
Absolutely.
I think many people in my experience who I've interacted with, they don't take those additional steps. They don't consider those additional options that are on their shoulders of the power they have, what they should do.
And it's not just power. But the power is both it's not something you beat people up with. It's simply the ability to say no, and it's the ability to make choices. It used to be, the people I knew who were job hunting would typically kind of like throw their resume out there and go to interviews and based on some relatively random criteria, take a job with somebody and then go somewhere else. And you'd say to them, hey, what are you learning? Oh, my employer doesn't have a budget for learning. And that's the attitudes that we really want to break, right? You have a career arc that you should be planning, you should be thinking about. And it's not fixed. You're not going to say in 30 years' time, I'm going to be at this. It's going to be, you know, for the next 5 years, I'm going to focus on building my technical skills or my management skills or, you know, my language skills, whatever it might be. And then you're going to look for the opportunities that let you do that. And if you cannot find an environment that exactly gives you those opportunities, then you make one. You do that by working on your own.
Yeah, and that's something I don't think we could possibly overstress or talk about too much is the idea of continuous learning and your responsibility to be continuously learning. And that means reading books, watching videos, going to conferences, whatever you do, you've got to keep it up truly constantly because so much is changing, so much new things are happening, there's new stuff to learn, there's old stuff falling by the wayside. You've really got to keep reading and keep up. And if you look at any of the biographies of, you know, wildly successful, inventive, creative people, you know, Elon Musk springs to mind, right? Voracious reader. I forget the stat offhand, but it's, you know, and just an unbelievable number of devouring, you know, a book a night on whatever topic is handy, you know, whether it's economics, whether it's physics, whether it's information theory, you know, whatever is sort of interesting at the time. Hey, this looks cool. Let me pull on that thread and see where this goes.
Yeah, and to add to that, it's not just the act of reading and stuff. I teach some university classes, and people will come to me quite often and say, okay, so what should I do for a job? And not like quite that blatant, but effectively they're saying, you know, what kind of job should I get? My response is pretty much always, it doesn't matter, because I hope you will change jobs every 18 months for the first 5-10 years of your career. Because really, that's the only way to dip your toe into enough puddles to find out what you like, what you don't like, to get the experience in the different industries. Because the other thing that a good developer brings is a really broad range of understanding. So quite often, if you've been doing work in, I don't know, say finance, you'll be able to apply a lot of what you've learned, not just technically, but also on a business side in, you know, if you join a streaming startup or whatever it might be, there's a whole bunch of stuff you can pick up. And you do that. I mean, if you look at the actual kind of like shape of the learning curve, it starts to flatten after a while. And at that point, you move on and you find a new domain to learn.
That's interesting because when you're a developer, you know, you get put in a certain role at a certain company, whether it's, of a particular technology or, you know, you are a junior developer or mid-level developer or senior developer, or what have you. And I think a lot of times people just see that they have to move up, like to progress. And it's not necessarily so. Like, you can move sideways or move within that role or learn things that are related to it, like what the finance team is doing or how you're going after work with, you know, pitch work for clients, etc., that will help you within that role grow within there without having to constantly worry about how to move up the ladder.
What you said about pitch work is phenomenally useful. Getting out there with doing sales support effectively is a really, really good way of getting to learn what the constraints are, you know, and how your company actually works. Also, you don't necessarily have to change jobs. If you were to work for some kind of consultancy that has a broad portfolio, then you can be, you know, working on totally different projects every couple of weeks if you wanted to. So, you know, just so long as you get that variety.
And that's, I think that's an advantage at smaller companies too, where everyone gets a chance to wear many hats because you have to, because there's only so many people involved. That's one of the dangers of a larger company where everyone gets pigeoned into this, you know, tiny little box. You can only ever do this. This is all you get to do. You don't even get to see, you know, necessarily the rest of the organization. That's a much more limited experience. And definitely if you were starting out, you know, I certainly wouldn't recommend that. You need something much broader.
Yeah, added to which, when you're just starting out, the risks of going to a small company are, you know, so what? This is your first or second job, yeah, and if the company collapses, big deal. It's not like you have, you know, a mortgage and kids to put through school and everything else at that point. So that's the, exactly the right time to be taking those kind of risks and doing things that are fun.
It reminds me of, you know, strategies for investing. Right. When you're younger, you can take a lot more riskier investments. And then as you progress, you take more reasonable ones that have less risk associated with them.
And don't forget that you have to diversify.
Yeah. And that's exactly with that point about, you know, every 18 months moving to something new, or even if it's not a different company, if you can move to a different technology. I think, Andy, like you said earlier, without having to focus on one thing and kind of get locked into that one technology, you can move on to whatever's upcoming, what you're learning about, and what you can apply to your role or move on to a new role with.
All right. And what's kind of funny was back when we wrote the first edition of the book, back at the turn of the century. Horrible. It sounds horrible.
Which century, Andy? Which century?
Yeah. We had suggested in the original edition that you should learn a new programming language every year. And I've had people say with a straight face, but we'll run out. There's only two or three languages. What do we do after we've learned Java and PHP? And it's like, oh, okay, so we have two problems here. You know, I mean, there's tons of interesting experimental little languages out there. There's tons of big, you know, I would consider the mainstream popular languages, all of which have very different approaches. I hate to use the word paradigm, but there it is. You know, different ways of problem solving. Learning any one of these, even if you never use it in your day job or it's not a corporate standard or whatever, that's not the point. It's going to expand your thinking. It's going to expand your problem solving abilities outside of that particular technology. And again, that's what we're on about. It's all about, you know, can we be better problem solvers?
Let me broaden that out a bit too, because I think many developers do focus on the language and sometimes even on like the language plus a particular framework for that language. You know, I'm a React developer or whatever it might be. And I think languages are clearly one of the most important tools that we use. So getting a good grounding in a variety of different language styles is important. So I would really recommend that people get good at an object-oriented language, at a functional language, and maybe surprisingly get good at JavaScript, which is actually JavaScript in a way is today's C, in that it's a really good base language. It's actually got a surprisingly sophisticated set of things you can do with it. So get good at those things, but then ask yourself what the incremental benefit of learning yet another language is. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you want to do it just for certain particular reasons. Maybe you need Go routines or whatever it might be. But also remember that you should be learning different techniques and technologies. So for example, if you have never programmed up a neural net or a deep learning type system, then go out and do so. And there are many tutorials on coding things like, you know, a number recognition algorithm from scratch. If you do that once, you'll end up with an incredibly deep understanding that you wouldn't get if you just like to use some off-the-shelf model and plug parameters into it. So all of those kind of things where you look at, you know, new ideas, new techniques, new technologies, not just in languages, but also in just what's available, and just mess around.
And it can be something fun too. I mean, you don't have to, you know, stick to necessarily number recognition or speech recognition. At the Pragmatic Bookshelf, we've got a whole book on how to solve mazes, how to write algorithms to solve mazes. There's a book on building your own ray tracer from scratch.
There's that chatbot one with AI in it.
So, yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of neat, interesting little projects that are, you know, I hate to say just for the fun of it, but kind of just for the fun of it. And you learn as you go. It's like, oh, okay. You know, you develop those extra insights and the, you know, the hair pulling moments and all of it, but you get that experience, you know, working these different things. And it can be fun.
Yeah, like right now I'm playing around with using like little small microcontroller type computers, like ESPs and stuff. That's kind of forcing me to learn a whole different language, a whole different vocabulary. But the amazing thing is that these little small boxes can do incredible things. I haven't got there yet, but all these kind of things are fun. I mean, Andy messes around with hydraulics. And he makes, well, you tell him, Andy.
For Halloween, right? You know, you really need to amp it up with Raspberry Pis and Arduinos and pneumatic cylinders and all this. So
a good traditional Halloween.
Good traditional high-tech Halloween. So, you know, different kinds of motion sensors over the years. And yeah, again, this is one of those learning things like, okay, well, we'd like it so that when, you know, the poor little kid walks by the particular prop, it jumps out of the ground and screams and the, you know, lasers and smoke and all the rest of this. So yeah, it's great fun. And, you know, in this case, at the end of the day, you get, you know, props jumping out and scaring people, which is just all around.
And when you have the hobby projects like that, where you're trying these new things, these other technologies that you won't necessarily use in your day to day, you start to learn how to think about, like you said, these real world problems. And you're going to start to do that in your job as well. If you're putting yourself more in those positions where you have to think that way, I think it carries through.
You know, it's amazing how much cross-fertilization there is. There's only like, you know, I don't know, six ideas in the entire world, and everything else is just implementation detail.
I want to thank you so much for being guests on the podcast. I'm excited for everyone to go out and read the 20th anniversary edition of The Pragmatic Programmer. I've been enjoying reading it. One of those books that I pick up, you know, every few years just to brush up on and get reinvigorated with what I'm doing. So I really appreciate all the work you two have done.
Well, I really appreciate the comment. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks again for having us.
And I want to thank Dave and Andy again for taking the time to be on the podcast. I thought it was a really great conversation. So I hope you got something out of that conversation. If you want to know more about Dave and Andy, there's many places you can find out about them. Twitter, just as one. You can find Dave at Prag Dave. That's PragDave. You can find Andy on Twitter at Pragmatic Andy. That's PragMaticAndy. You can also find them at the Pragmatic Bookshelf. And if you want to read the book, especially the new 20th anniversary edition, you can go to informit.com/developing up. So that's informit.com/developing up. And then on checkout, use the checkout code developing up, all one word. And that's going to get you 35% off the book or the ebook. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, whether you're a new listener or returning listener, I would hope you'd want to share it with your friends, your peers, your coworkers, your family, your network of other developers. You can do that a number of ways. One, you can share the show notes for this episode, which is found at developingup.com/47. And also you can help other developers find it by using your favorite podcasting app, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Google Play or Spotify or Stitcher, and leave us a rating and review. You know, that's the way that will help other developers find this and benefit from the content. If you want to listen to any of our previous content, again, that's all available at developingup.com. It has all our previous episodes from all the previous seasons. So go ahead and catch up on anything you missed. You can always reach out on Twitter at DevUpPodcast or myself at MikeMiles86 or send an email at hello@developingup.com. You know, I appreciate all the communications I've been getting from people and what they have to say and sharing their thoughts on the podcast and ideas. So I welcome that communication. Till next episode, happy developing.